from the Sky News Centre at 5. Police say they'll continue to investigate the murder of two British soldiers outside Mazarine Barracks in 2009, despite a man being found guilty of killing them. Brian Shivers has been convicted of shooting dead sappers Patrick Azimkar and Mark Quincy. Quincy's sister Jamie has appealed for anyone with information about the murders to tell police.
It brings great comfort to know that this case is not closed. We know there are more people involved and we want to see them sentenced. My world has been torn apart. I can't change that. But please help the police.
A second defendant, Colin Duffy, was acquitted of all the charges. In other news, three Muslim men from Derby have been convicted of handing out leaflets calling for gays to be executed. In the first case since the new laws were introduced, they've been found guilty of intending to stir up hatred on the grounds of sexual orientation. A paedophile who became the first person to be extradited from China to the UK has been jailed. 69-year-old David Price skipped bail on a false passport in 2003 after being caught with indecent pictures of children. A neonatal room at a hospital in Belfast is being deep cleaned after three babies died from an infection. A bacteria called Pseudomonas has caused the deaths at the Royal Jubilee Maternity Hospital. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
BCFM 93.2 is a charity and works with the diverse communities in Bristol. So please continue to support us by getting involved and spreading the word.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and helping us review this week's news is Conservative councillor for Avonmouth and the group spokesperson for transport, Siobhan Kennedy-Hall. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, mayhem in Syria, or so the TV news would have us believe. So this week, NATO has soldiers on the ground. That was an admission in about Libya. So could they be doing the same in Syria? And from phone hacking to the Leveson inquiry. On the week, privatised Ian Hislop took the floor. Is this just another inquiry going nowhere, like the Chilcot inquiry into the illegal invasion of Iraq? Magdalena Kropka from Ujima Radio in St Paul's joins us to discuss how well Bristol and London's media is serving the public. And the European Particle Research Centre near Geneva, CERN. From there, Sabine McNeil went on to set up the Forum for Stable Currencies and is now campaigning for victims of miscarriages of justice and of bizarre anonymous phone calls she's been getting. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius, dry but windy. This weekend, highs of 10 Celsius, cloudier on Saturday, sunnier on Sunday, but windy. Next week, highs again, 10 Celsius, getting colder as the week progresses. A fair amount of sunshine this week, but cloudier and wetter midweek. Next weekend, that's the 28th and 29th of January, highs down to 1 Celsius, a bit more normal for the time of year. And next weekend, sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining us is Conservative Councillor for Avonmouth and Group Spokesperson for Transport, Siobhan Kennedy-Hall. Hi Siobhan, welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, thank you very much.
Now tell us first of all what got you into politics.
Well, to be honest, it wasn't actually about getting into politics. I wanted to help more people. I'd got to a time in my life where I wanted to give something back. I felt that I wanted to be able to help the local people through the sort of labyrinth of the council and to be able to assist them with some of their problems. So it was far more altruistic than actually wanting to get involved in politics.
You just found that politics was the way to do what you wanted to do.
Yes, it sort of came along at the right time. And being a local councillor, in my opinion, is actually about supporting the local people. We are actually elected by the local people and we are put in place to assist with the running of Bristol City Council, which is for the people. So surely that is what we're here to do.
OK, so why did you choose the Conservatives rather than one of the other parties? Because one of the things we keep hearing nowadays is that, hey, all these political parties, they're just the same, really.
How many times did I hear that when I was campaigning? Oh, you politicians, you're all the same. To be honest, I've always been a Conservative. I grew up in a Conservative family. I agree with the morals and ethics of the Conservatives. I grew up in the times of Thatcher, and I have a lot of admiration for that woman, although there were certainly some things that I don't agree with that she did. But it's just, I suppose, how I've grown up, and it's a moral code, realistically, that I've followed. And it's more that than the actual politics.
Now, you've sort of brought up the issue of Mrs. Thatcher there, because in the second hour, we're looking at the Leveson Inquiry, and we're also looking at local radio and broadcasting. One of the things that Margaret Thatcher did during the 1980s was she started to allow the sort of rise of Rupert Murdoch's empire as he took over the Sun and the Times during that time, and also she was quite one of the important things she did was she started to stop these rules about cross-media ownership. And this is one of the right things that helped Murdoch thrive, which was that he could buy up a TV station, he could buy a newspaper, he could buy books, you know, HarperCollins, for example, he owns, and this was something that couldn't happen before those rules were relaxed.
Very true, and I have to question, was it the right thing to do? It became a domination of the marketplace. It doesn't allow for the variety that should be out there, in my opinion.
Okay, and also Mrs. Thatcher was seen as divisive, wasn't she? Because there was a wider separation of earnings under her. There was a lot of erosion of the rights for people to go on strike, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. I do actually remember many years ago when we had all the power cuts and strikes. I remember the days of when the rubbish was just piling up on the pavements. And I have to question, was that the right way of dealing with things? It created a lot of unrest with people that didn't understand the situation. And striking is one action that can be taken, but I don't really feel that it's the right way of doing it. Yep. It's like nurses giving up working in a hospital for a day. What are the ill people going to do? How are the elderly going to cope? Would that be right for nurses to do that? No, it wouldn't.
Now, the other thing is, you're a spokesperson for the Conservative group on the City Council for Transport, and that's another place where the Thatcher government did make some changes in things like the privatisation of buses. I think it was the major government, actually, that did railways. But this is now where people are looking back at this and saying, well, actually, this wasn't the right way to go, you know, because we're looking at our transport situation in the city now. And in the old days, actually, the City Council used to run the bus system, and it used to work very well.
It did, but that was also with a lot less lower population and a lot fewer cars and a lot less need for actual people moving around. There was a far more localism with regards to employment and in education. I think realistically what we need to do is go back even further and look at what Beeching did to the railways. We're now trying to actually undo that. I'd like to bring on the subject of the Friends of Bristol Suburban Railway. They in fact have their AGM tomorrow in Avonmouth at 6:30. But they are actually campaigning for improved railways to be putting back into use both railway lines along the Severn Beach line so that people can use public transport. So we have an improved public transport. It is desperately needed.
But there's something wrong, isn't there, where the rail operators, such as First Great Western, need to be almost forced to open these railway lines for them to be successful. Why can't they, as commercial businesses, see the potential there and do it without, you know, the community elbowing them into it?
It does also come back to the length of franchise and also the level of investment that's required. Now, the franchise terms are not actually that long, and there is always a risk that they are going to lose that franchise to somebody else. Therefore, the level of investment isn't actually being put in. And I think we need to look at how franchises are given out. And it goes without saying that a company shouldn't be just working on the economics. Yes, everybody is in business to make a profit, but if you're providing a service, it's not just about the profit. You do have to provide that service as well. I'm fed up, not with my constituents, but with hearing complaints about buses. They don't turn up on time. The drivers are rude. They just drive past. You know, it's the old adage, you know, you don't see one bus for ages and then three come along. And, you know, it needs to be revolutionised. But First Group do seem to have the monopoly within Bristol, which is completely wrong.
So what would you do to change all that then?
Well, that's a very big question. We need to look at the actual fare system. We need to look at the park and ride. We've got a situation where a park and ride fee is actually, you know, pennies less than just getting onto a First Group bus. But the bus costs, so the actual ticket costs, are so high. This is putting people off using them. If people aren't using them, first group then take the services away. So then we have even poorer public transportation. We need to actually turn it upside down and say, right, we've got to have some investment in this. We've actually got to get first group to recognise that, yes, they can have a longer term contract if they reduce the prices, if they do out something, rather than putting out television adverts that have really riled an awful lot of people within Bristol because it bore no relation to the actual service that is received.
But what's going on, Siobhan, when you are, as a city councillor, are sort of asking, begging, we want them to persuade them to do this. It's a bit like the Treasury trying to persuade the City of London to lend to small businesses. We want our politicians to tell these people what to do, not to just sort of cross their fingers, get down on their knees and ask them.
Within the scrutiny commissions, we only have very limited powers. And I have to say, I am actually on record a number of times about stating that I want complaints put forward to First Group. They do have a monopoly. It should be changed. And to be honest, I'm probably going to get shot down now by my own party and let alone the rest of the council. But I do genuinely believe that Bristol City Council should be run as a business, and therefore the suppliers of services should be also beholden to us to operate that service, yes, as a business, but to give us the best service that they can. And I believe that we can get far more out of Bristol City Council than we're currently getting.
Now, I know just before we came on the air, you were talking about the ice rink. That's for a lot of people, they see this as kind of symptom of the slow slide of the city as part of the cuts and the recession. What are your thoughts about that?
Absolutely. I mean, that ice rink has been around longer than I have. I did actually have my second ever kiss at that ice rink. It holds a lot of memories for me. My son has gone ice skating there. It's a wonderful venue for children, teenagers and adults alike. But there's been no investment in it because the building owners haven't invested in the ice rink, and that John Knight has not been able to because he's never known how long he's going to be able to keep that rink open. And we're now in a situation where we're going to lose something that has been in Bristol for 45 years, that Robin Cousins learnt to skate in. We've lost the Robin Cousins Sports Centre in Avonmouth, which went years ago, and it's been sitting empty and derelict. You know, we keep losing things that should be being run by Bristol City Council and being run effectively as businesses, making small profits, but providing the services there for our people of Bristol.
The other thing, of course, is last week we heard that the City Council's borrowing £50 million, really effectively, to tide them over the next set of elections, so they don't have to be closing things down, that they can have, even if it's quite a small, proactive programme of capital investment. Otherwise, because of the recession, they would have had to cut £50 million. So do you think this is the right way to go, if the city is being run, as you like say, you like to see it as a business, to be borrowing money at this stage? £50 million? Surely they should be getting that from the council tax.
My naive view, not as an economist, is no, they shouldn't be borrowing more money. If you look at your own household budget, you don't keep on spending money if you don't have it. You don't keep on borrowing money. You don't keep on spending on credit cards and remortgaging if you can't afford
but
it.
But the alternative is more places like the ice rink being run down, more places like the Robin Cousins Centre being run down.
I think, to be honest, we've probably lost most of what we've got already. The ice skating rink is a slight anomaly because it's actually being sold by developers for, you know, making a quick profit rather than investing in it and making a slow profit. They're going to provide more student accommodation. John Knight, I will say, has actually said that he would like to have a development in Stockwood area, to have a housing development and actually put a £10 million ice skating rink down there. Let's keep our fingers crossed that something like that can actually happen, so we still have that within Bristol. But I do believe that we can find savings elsewhere, that we can rejuggle the books, we can look at more effective working and find savings so that we don't have to continue borrowing more money.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. Hi, Martin. I've got a Hello. Special article for you this week to comment on, which is from your, someone you mentioned, so I didn't say your hero, but someone that you speak about from time to time. It's Brian Gould. Yep. Writing in the New Zealand Herald this week, blind faith in markets robs the nation of its full potential. Now, can you just comment on what Brian's been saying?
Well, most people probably don't remember Brian Gould. He was actually deputy leader of the Labour Party in the early 80s, and he was one of the founders of the New Labour Project. And as I've said on this show before, he was John Smith's second in command, and he went to John Smith and said, look, I'm from New Zealand. We started building a welfare state in 1936. And what we've got to do is we've got to take on the City of London. And John Smith said to him, no, we're not going to take on the City of London. I'm going to, he went for the prawn cocktail offensive, which he said, I'm going to get the City of London on side. We're going to say the Labour Party isn't going to make any trouble for you. We're absolutely safe. Vote for us. And what Brian Gould said, to his great credit, is if that's what you want to do, John, I'm going home to New Zealand. And he's now the rector of Waikato University in New Zealand. And he blogs on Our Politics. And the Labour Party went down the drain at that point. And Brian Gould said to his Labour colleagues in this country, you people just ain't serious. And in New Zealand, they've got a fantastic Labour tradition. They didn't. You see, most people think that the welfare state in 1945 was built in this country and then New Zealand copied us. No, we copied New Zealand. They also gave women the vote in 1888, 50 years before we did.
What he's suggesting, though, is that actually inequalities, that when a society gets a big inequality between rich and poor, it's actually really destructive to the society, because apparently some say, like some in the Conservative Party say, that actually it's really important to have big financial rewards for people who, entrepreneurs are creating wealth. I'll just read a little extract from his article. He says, what the apologists for inequality do not grasp is that we are all, including the wealthy, made worse off, not only because we live in a more divided and less cohesive society, but also because by diverting so much national wealth into so few pockets, we undervalue and make poor use of the productive potential of the rest of us. So we produce less as a country than we should. And I suppose what he's talking about here is the skills of individuals who are just simply not being put to use because there's not the money to employ them.
Well, when they started building a welfare state in New Zealand in the 30s, they were told, yeah, you can't do this, you can't do this, you're a small country, you'll bankrupt yourselves. And you know what they said? She'll be right. And they were right. And of course, we can do whatever we want to do. And many Conservatives, I mean, I did a Speaker's Corner event earlier, Siobhan, and you know who built the most council houses in this country? Harold Macmillan, a Conservative.
Absolutely.
A Conservative. And this is not actually a party political thing. The idea of having a fairer society where everybody gets a fair go, as the Aussies say, that's not a Labour thing or a Conservative thing. It's just the thing, isn't it?
Absolutely, and it's the way it should be. But we've turned into, within this country, a society where, yes, we've got the haves and the have-nots, and we've got this element of the have-nots that feel that they're entitled to having everything.
We're talking about the bankers now, are we? Or the people who make money on the property market?
No, you're just being controversial there now.
Well, but I would be, wouldn't I?
You know, I mean, I can speak from experience. I have a number of lodgers in my house. I'm fortunate to be able to have a house that's got unoccupied bedrooms. I rent those out. It enables people that wouldn't be able to live.
Are they on
elsewhere.
Housing benefit?
Interestingly
Martin,
enough.
Martin, just let Siobhan finish, please.
Mm. No, this is true. Yes. I've got a couple.
Martin.
Hang on.
We're just letting the lady finish, yeah? I've switched your microphone off, so we're not listening to you right now, Martin, okay?
Thank you. No, they're a young couple. She's in her 20s, he's in his 30s. And unfortunately, they are a product of bad parenting and poor education and parents that haven't given them any sense of worth or value, and they don't have anything to strive for. And it's quite interesting, and it has horrified me, to be honest, to have people that are quite happy to sit around doing nothing.
But
and
Siobhan,
expecting to
isn't,
have
isn't the point here that sometimes particularly with young people, I mean, we've seen 50,000 young people added to the unemployment list for the last 3 months this week. It's a massive increase. For a lot of young people, they've tried to get a job, trying again, and eventually they think, well, hang on a minute, there's something wrong here. I'm not going to just continually try and get jobs week after week after week, day after day after day, without success. And it's dispiriting for people when they're trying. They know they've got the skills to do a job, but they're being rejected. I think we heard this week in Lewisham in South London, for every three jobs, there's 200 people going for each of those three jobs.
I'm not saying it's not difficult. I was made redundant twice in 2010 within a three-month period of time. It was pretty horrendous for myself, but I was very fortunate, and I have been fortunate through my life. I was brought up to value education. I had very strict parents, well, my mother especially, and I was actually brought up to strive for what I get. And I have, apart from one instance where I was made unemployed and I had 6 weeks, I think I was on the dole, as it was then, I have always paid my own way. And I genuinely know that it's hard. My son is a student at the moment and he's trying to get some part-time work. He has to fund his own college fees. He has to fund his own food money and he cannot get any work. So I know how difficult it is, but he is trying. He is trying everything that he can do. But you have to keep trying. Yes. What is the point of giving up
that.
And just accepting benefits?
No one's necessarily saying that, but what I'm saying is there are a lot of people out there who are on the margins, who are maybe low paid, who are in a situation now where they see their gas bills going up, their electricity bills going up, transport. I mean, we've just had the train fares going up 9%, and they're working all the hours God sends just simply to pay the bills, and sometimes they can't even afford to pay those, including rent. I mean, we don't see landlords saying, oh well, we're in hard times now, so we're going to drop the rent for you.
I'm sorry, landlords should. I mean, they need to look at their own pockets. They shouldn't just be lining their own pockets. We are a society. And a society is actually not just about the individual. It's about everybody. And this is where it comes back into community and neighbourhoods. We ought to be looking after each other. We can't just keep on thinking of ourselves. Yes, everybody's got their own self-interest, but you need to look at the bigger picture. You know, there's the phrase, no man is an island. And I'm sorry, that's absolutely true. I barter with my son. I get him to do stuff in the garden for me that I don't have the time for. I give them meals and cook for them. You know, I've done that with local people. I make my own jams. I've got chickens, so I've got eggs. And I barter with local people for things that they want to give me in return for jams and eggs. You know, that is the way of doing it. It also means you get to know more people. It's being part of that big society. Now, sorry to use a Cameron phrase, but you know, I am a conservative.
Yesterday, David Cameron gave a quite long speech, and I had to listen through all of it, and some of it really didn't seem to make much sense. There wasn't a lot of policy in it, but it was all about socially responsible capitalism. So let's have a listen to an excerpt from that speech now, where he talks about the difficult times and the fact that he's got a plan for them.
But these are difficult times. We have to deal with the legacy of the deficit and the debt. The Eurozone is in deep and continuing trouble. And yesterday, unemployment rose again. And across Europe, economies have stalled. Here in Britain, it's clear that this is an active government. Its sleeves are rolled up. We're doing everything we possibly can to get our economy moving. The biggest work programme since the 1930s, helping 3 million people. A massive drive on apprenticeships. Major initiatives on regional growth, on infrastructure, on enterprise. But today, if we're frank, many people are questioning not just how and when we'll recover, but they're questioning the whole way in which our economy works. So while our economic challenge starts with dealing with our debts and achieving growth, it mustn't end there. We must aim higher than just coping with the storms that are affecting the international economy. Because I believe that out of this current adversity, we must aim to build a better economy, one that is truly fair and worthwhile. And my argument today is this. We won't build a better economy by turning our back on the free market. We'll do it by making sure that market is fair as well as free.
That was David Cameron speaking yesterday in part of his speech about socially responsible capitalism. Martin, what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, we hear similar rhetoric from the Labour front bench, and the fact of the matter is that we're in the most serious economic crisis in my lifetime, and I'm 52 years old. The banks are likely to collapse completely in the next period. The Labour leadership don't seem to understand that, and the Tory leadership don't understand it either. In fact, the political class in this country are way off. They're away with the fairies, in my view. And, of course, we want a better, fairer society. We all say that. But it's all about macroeconomics and understanding how it works. And when you said earlier, Siobhan, we all know that we've all got households and we all know you can't pay what you haven't earned. I used to teach A-level economics. And the first thing we used to teach them, 16, 17 years old, is it doesn't work like that. It's counterintuitive, but a national economy does not work like a household. That's why it's called advanced level economics. And unfortunately, Mr. Osborne is a historian.
Okay, let's have a little bit more of a listen to Cameron's speech, this time about Labour's Faustian Pact. Then we'll hear Siobhan's comments.
Truth is, the last government made something of a Faustian pact with the city. It encouraged a debt-crazed economy because it needed to pay for spiralling welfare costs and a very much top-down interventionist state. It tolerated market failures because at heart it didn't really accept that markets could be made to work properly. It seemed frightened of challenging vested interests, believing too often that the interests of big business were always one and the same as those of the economy as a whole. Now, all of this left us with a level of public spending we couldn't afford and a model of economic growth that wouldn't work. Now, I understand why this has made many people totally disenchanted with markets, even angry. Because far from abolishing boom and bust, what we had was the biggest boom and then the biggest bust, leaving everyone with a share of the debt. But when things went well, only a few seemed to get a share of the profit. Too many people found they couldn't count on their savings growing. They couldn't afford to buy a home. They worried about how they'd pay their bills in old age. And the city, which should have been a powerhouse of competition and creativity, became instead a byword for a sort of financial wizardry that left the taxpayer with all the risk and a fortunate few with all of the rewards. So instead of a popular capitalism, we ended up with an unpopular capitalism.
It's David Cameron speaking yesterday. Unpopular capitalism, Siobhan. What are we going to do about it? What's your party going to do about it particularly?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, if I was in power, I'd possibly have all the answers, but I don't. I feel somewhat put in my place by Martin. I have to say, I didn't do economics. I am a scientist by training. I do understand that we do have to have spending, we do have to have borrowing in order for the whole economy to work. But I still feel that we must pay off the debts. We must actually undo a lot of the bad that has been done. And therefore, that means we have to go through very austere times.
But the problem is, isn't it, that as we go through all these austerity measures, people have less money to spend. And that basically the economic activity goes right down. The taxes go right down. It seems to be almost like a kind of what they call a death spiral, where people have got less and less and less money, less and less tax coming in, and it becomes less possible to pay off these long-term debts.
Absolutely. But do we really want to live in a country where all we have are shopping centres and shopping areas that are replicated right across the country? I travel on business and I see the same shops, the same shopping areas all over the place. We used to be Great Britain. We used to be one of the leaders in manufacturing. We used to be the leaders in science. We need to build upon that rather than having everybody wanting the biggest plasma TV on their wall, the best car, the newest kitchen. We've got to look at some rationale here. We have to stop spending for the sake of spending and actually sometimes make do amend and repair where we've gone wrong.
Martin, isn't one of the problems here, and one of the things Cameron's referring to here, is that we've got a whole area of the economy that isn't actually making anything. This whole banking and finance, and particularly investment banking sector, which is making money, but it's not actually making anything real. And it's also not supporting our businesses, well, our manufacturing.
Well, to be honest with you, I welcome David Cameron talking the rhetoric of disciplining the city. And in many ways, it would be much better coming from the Conservative Party than the Labour Party. I spoke earlier about Brian Gould. If the Labour Party had decided to take on the city rather than not take them on in the 1980s, for example, the Big Bang, which is actually the source of a lot of our problems, we would have had a huge fight. We would have had a huge fight. People would have made it really difficult. And in many ways, what you might call one nation conservatism would be the best option in terms of disciplining the city. And when David Cameron was elected with liberal support, I had some hopes that he might be prepared to take them on. But actually, the Labour leadership isn't prepared to take them on, and this is all talk, because in actual fact, the euro is going to collapse in the next 3 weeks, then the banks are going to collapse, and then we're going to have absolutely mass unemployment and a war with Iran. And that's a business, I'm afraid. It's not about local stuff.
Okay.
But that's the way. That's the world. No, I'm not fatalistic. We've come to this point. We didn't have to be at this point.
But do you not think that it's a benefit, therefore, that we're not actually part of the euro?
I think it is a benefit. It was Gordon Brown that kept us out of the euro, and of course, my favourite country is Norway. It's not even the
not even
in the European Union.
No, but in my opinion, it wasn't just Gordon Brown. It was actually the people of this country that kept us out of the euro.
Yes, but what we're going to find now is that Britain has actually got a far higher debt to GDP ratio than most euro countries. I was looking at something from Steve Keener, who's an Australian economist. We're about we are really, really vulnerable. When the euro goes down, the City of London is actually at the centre of the financial markets in the whole world. So anybody who goes down anywhere, it comes straight back to us. Straight back to us. And the City of London is going to be, you're a scientist, it's going to be like a black hole. And it's going to suck everything in, as it has done for many generations. And this is a very, very serious moment.
But Martin, as we heard over Christmas, Treasury...
I'm not trying to make a political point, because I think the Conservative Party, with the kind of values you have, has something to offer here.
But Martin, to be fair, your gloom scenario has, you have been saying this for the last couple of years, and we did hear
over
Christmas that the Treasury are now seriously looking at an Armageddon scenario.
They are indeed. The Treasury are working over the weekend because they know very well if
that sort of thing does happen, that at least there is a plan rather than it being a black hole with no way out.
Yes.
Let's just go back then to Mr. Cameron's speech, the final part of it, where it was amazing. He started talking about cooperatives. He sounded like a sort of Northern Labour MP saying that that this was the future and that we needed more co-ops. So let's have a listen to that.
Now, there are over 12 million co-op members in the UK. It is, if you like, a vital branch of popular capitalism. But right now, there are too many barriers in the way to extending and improving that record. There are over a dozen separate and outdated pieces of legislation that add cost and complexity to the process. So today I can announce they'll all be brought together and simplified in a new cooperatives bill that we'll be putting before Parliament. Now I want, in these difficult economic times, to achieve more than just paying down the deficit and encouraging growth. I want these times to lead to a more socially responsible and genuinely popular capitalism, one in which the power of the market and the obligations of responsibility really come together. One in which we improve the market by making it fair as well as free, and in which many more people get a stake in the economy and a share in the rewards of success. That is the vision of a better, more worthwhile economy that we're building. An economy where people who work hard get rewards that are fair in the true conservative sense of the word. An economy where people feel in control of their destiny, because they've started their own business, or they're shareholders in the company they work for, or indeed a part of a cooperative. An economy where everyone has the chance to build up assets, to pass something on to the next generation. That is how we'll make markets work for all of us, to spread wealth, to spread freedom, and to spread opportunity. Thank you very much indeed for listening.
That was David Cameron speaking yesterday, and his talk was entitled Socially Responsible Capitalism. Now, Siobhan, are you convinced? Do you think that there is actually the money out there to make this happen, to actually get, I suppose what we're talking about here, is get a lot of people who have skills but don't have jobs back into work?
Absolutely, but it has to be a mindset change as well. People have to stop expecting something for nothing. We are in a society where far too many people believe that it is their inherent right to be able to own their own home, to be paid to live, in effect, whilst doing nothing. And I feel if we can get the mindset changed and have people being proud of being British and being proud of living in this country and wanting to better not just themselves but their country, then yes, it is entirely doable, but we all have to work together. And the very large companies must stop trying to hide and their profits and avoiding paying taxes. We need that money back into the country. It's not just about the shareholders. We have to have them pay their taxes as they should. Creative accounting is all very well and good, but it's only for the few, not for the masses.
But David Cameron's got a public relations marketing background, and he's talking about lots of new people being employed, new businesses starting. He was talking about the entrepreneurs and people from academies with all these opportunities fizzing away there. But actually, what we hear is, in the news this week, 120,000 more unemployed. I mean, it seems that what he's talking about bears no relation to the actual statistics and reality. Are you saying that all these unemployed people are simply lazy?
No, not at all. However, I do believe that, unfortunately, there are situations where people have to be less choosy about what jobs they go for. Nobody can always have everything they want first time. You know, you have to work at it. And I remember when I was younger and when I had a young son, I actually said that if it came to it, I would do anything. I would go and stick my hand down toilets and clean toilets in order to bring money in. I would do anything in order to support my family. And I think that people need to recognise that you do, unfortunately, have to work hard to get rewards.
So, Martin, what are your thoughts about this? Particularly what Cameron was saying about co-ops there, which is amazing. I've not heard.
Well, I mean, it sounds like New Labour redux, actually. I mean, I used to work in the co-op sector, and I'm very, very familiar with this kind of rhetoric. And in a way, I welcome this kind of talk from the Conservative leadership. But the fact of the matter is that cutting public expenditure at this moment in the economic cycle is lunacy. The Treasury know. Everybody knows. I was reading in The Observer, top civil servants speaking anonymously said, this government is a shower. We don't expect them to last very long because they haven't got a clue. You should not be cutting public expenditure at this moment at all. It's lunacy. As you cut public expenditure, private investment will go down, unemployment will go up. It's macroeconomics, not chemistry, macroeconomics. And unfortunately, the Labour leadership this week have really blown it because they've basically given in to this, oh, we got to go along with it. If we're going to win Basildon in 2015, we've got to persuade the Daily Mail readers that we're going to cut back. And we all know we've got to cut back. And all I can say to that with my Oxford degree in economics is phooey, rubbish. I don't care if David Osborne is a millionaire. They're all millionaires. I mean, do you know how much Cameron's worth? 30 million quid. Not as much as Tony Blair. He's worth 60 million quid. But you know what I'm worth? Nothing. But you know what? I've got a top Oxford degree in economics, and this is rubbish. And my tutors would be looking at this going, what the hell are they talking about?
Now, this week we had, quite amazingly, the threat of disaffiliation from the Labour Party from the GMB union. So, Martin, is that kind of thing you're talking about? Because the unions are basically saying what you're saying in a way.
Well, you know what happened?
They will refuse to pay for, you know, sort of contributions towards the Labour Party because they think that they're so off course.
Well, you know what happened in New Zealand in the early 1980s? When we voted for Thatcher, they voted Labour because it's a Labour country. And they voted Labour to keep all this free market nonsense out. But the Treasury in New Zealand had been captured by the IMF, and I knew people who used to work in there. And so they had a Labour government, which the first thing they did was privatise the railways. It took 16 years for the Tories to dare to try and privatise the railways in this country. But in 1980, the Labour government privatise the railways, and the activists in New Zealand immediately understood what was going on. So we voted Labour, but we're going to get all this rubbish anyway. And you know what? They knocked on every door in the country. There's only 3 million people there. They said, we want a referendum on PR. And they forced a referendum on PR. They won the referendum on PR. And you know what happened? The right wing of the Labour Party, the Blairite wing, were smashed. They didn't elect anybody. Nobody. And then they renationalised the railways. Crash, bang, wallop, like the New Zealand back row. And okay, that's what we need to learn a bit of Southern Hemisphere politics around here.
OK, now let's have a listen to Ed Balls, because he got a bit of a grilling on Wednesday evening on Newsnight on this very subject of the possible disaffiliation of the unions from the Labour Party because of their failure to fight the cuts.
Look, we're the opposition, and the government, a Conservative-led government, is making terrible mistakes on the economy. They're cutting too far and too fast. Unemployment is rising. It's having a very difficult impact upon people working in the private and in the public sector.
And you're agreeing with the policy, broadly.
But Labour cannot, from opposition, change that until we're in government. And to be in government, we've got to set out an alternative, but it's got to be a credible alternative. And if we come along and say, look, we could be popular with the trade unions today by saying, we'll spend more, we'll tax less, let's pay people more. But if people say, well, that doesn't add up, that doesn't make us credible, it makes us less credible. What we've got to do is say there is a better way, a fairer way, to get the deficit down, to get the economy moving, to get growth and jobs back.
Right.
A 5-point plan for jobs and growth, tough decisions on pay, but also done in a fair way.
But just on the specific point, do you take seriously the threat from the GMB to disaffiliate from the Labour Party?
Well, I don't want the GMB or Unite to disaffiliate from the Labour Party.
So you take it seriously? You
do take it seriously. Look, I want people to be working together for a stronger, fairer future for our country. But we can't make our policy on the basis of that. We've got to make our policy on what would be the best way forward for the country and what could show Labour in a credible way can make difficult decisions when we will be faced with clearing up a very difficult Tory economic mess.
That was Ed Balls. I think it was Gavin Esler interviewing him on Newsnight earlier this week. What do you make of that, Martin?
Well, I'm dismayed, absolutely dismayed. I mean, Ed Balls is probably the most intelligent guy in British politics. And no, he is. He's a top economist. And that is rubbish, what he's saying. Absolute rubbish.
I mean, he's basically, isn't he, saying
what
that
they're doing
they can't
is capitulating instead of arguing.
Well, he's saying that what he's saying is he doesn't think he can get elected on your platform.
What he doesn't know, you know what's happening? We've had a Blairite coup inside the Labour Party in the last few weeks. And also, of course, they've got all these cephologists whispering in their ears saying, we've got to win Basildon in 2014 and they'll have different constituencies. So we all know what it's about. There's 200,000 people in the country who read the Daily Mail and you've got to convince them that you're credible to win. But you know what? What really gives me some hope, you know who's standing much to the left of all of this is the Democratic Unionist Party in Northern Ireland. They are absolutely opposed to the cuts. They're going to stand with Sinn Féin, with Plaid Cymru, with the SNP and the Greens. And the left wing of the Labour Party, if we can get it organised. We should disaffiliate. What the union should do is say, if you don't play ball, we're taking the money off you and we're going to play another game. It's Southern Hemisphere politics.
So, Siobhan, I imagine for you, this is quite delightful to see the Labour Party and the opposition sort of fighting amongst themselves.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, of course it is. But, I mean, it's just ridiculous because, I mean, Ed Balls is just basically saying, well, you know, we're not going to do what's right for the country because we need to get the votes. And it's inferring that we've got a population that wouldn't understand the right thing. So who's dumbing down what? Where? Yet again, the Labour Party are just making out that nobody knows what they're doing in this country. And they're showing themselves to be the top of that list.
OK, now we're joined by Marina Morris. Hi, Marina.
Hello. We will talk about teachers. Teachers appear to have become a target for the government's agenda for educational revolution. The Education Secretary Michael Gove has outlined plans to speed up the dismissal of teachers who fail to improve their pupils' performance. He is also calling for longer school days and shorter summer holidays. The plans would also remove the current 3 hours a year time limit during which a teacher's performance can be observed in class. Ofsted is also planning to turn up the heat on the 28% of the UK school currently rated as satisfactory. The teaching union are quoting evidence that the teachers are already working 60 hours a week and claim that the answer is to raise teaching standards through support and continuing professional development. They are already in ongoing negotiations with government, which appear to be stalling concerning proposed change to the teachers' pension scheme. According to the BBC's Panorama, only 18 UK teachers have been struck off for incompetence in the past 40 years. Government schemes in the recent past have tried to entice graduates in the teaching which schemes to repay student debt or to pay a golden hello to new teachers. It is now sending out a new message to prospective teachers. Shape up quick or risk being thrown out these massive student debts. The role of education for the personal and country's future prosperity is clear. Society needs a good teacher. The question is, do we punish or retrain poorly performing teachers? And how will this affect both teachers and the whole of society, all of us? Can we succeed as a society this broken link between respect, care, obligation, and the native norms and values of the country? What do you, Bristolian, think?
Thanks, Marina. And now you've been out and about on the streets, so let's have a listen to what you say about this topic.
Should it be easier to dismiss poorly performing teachers?
They should change how they do it. I think there should be more training for teachers. It should be more performance evaluation, but not dismiss them. They've worked hard to get to that point.
I think it's completely dependent on each individual case to sort of either dismiss poorly performing teachers. I think something needs to go for a lot more than just. It's not a simple question, I don't think.
I think so. Other people in other walks of life are under pressure to perform. I don't see why teachers shouldn't be either, as long as it's done properly.
I think there should be a way to encourage, to improve teachers. You can't just get rid of them.
What are the consequences for the pupils' future of having a poor teacher?
Pupils' learning is up to themselves. I had crap teachers in school and I did okay. Teachers, I think they've got a hard job. Students aren't easy to get along with. I work with young people myself. They're not easy. At the end of the day, the child's learning is up to themselves. If you want to learn, you learn. Got little to do with your teacher.
I think it's really important. I think especially with subjects that are more creative and that involve like more of a sort of teacher role as opposed to them just relaying the information. It's important that a child has a relationship with that teacher and they are essentially a role model for that particular area of their life. And it could be their passion in life, whether it's art or something.
Very serious. I suppose everyone should have an equal opportunity, and if some children have got teachers that aren't as good as others, then they're not getting the same opportunity.
I think I've had quite a few poor teachers. If you haven't got grades, then it has consequences if you don't get your grades. But then again, you can't just blame the teacher for it. You've always got to do your own work.
Is being a teacher a respected job, and what makes a good teacher?
I think it's a good job. I don't think people respect it enough. They should. I'm pro-teachers. I think they do an amazing job. I guess someone who listens to their students, who knows a way to encourage them and get them excited about learning, but isn't afraid to, you know, tell them things that they don't want to hear, you know, tell them off if they're misbehaving. They can carry a room, entertaining and informative enough, but firm at the same time.
I think someone that can empathise with each pupil, that's the important thing, and trying to be assertive, but also give an impression that they're not just, but they're being assertive for their own good, so it's not just them being power hungry. And I continue certain subjects because of certain teachers, so I think it's really important how much of an effect they have on pupils' learning.
Very important job. Good communicator, a good understanding, a good empathy with children, wanting children to succeed, and I suppose they need to be good disciplinarians or sensible disciplinarians these days.
I don't think teachers get us enough respect, but it's usually by students that have had to go through all the boring work and hadn't enjoyed it much that don't really respect teachers. I think as you get older, you realise what some of them have done for you. Guests have to be inspiring. They have to be on everyone's level, not just to go for a certain standard that they want, because obviously everybody's different. Just be creative, be helpful for what you want to do in life, whether it's the subject they're teaching, or make their subject relevant to whatever you want to do in life.
I mean, one of the dangers, Siobhan, with the current situation with the pension strike is that there's a lot of criticism of teachers. From what you've been hearing there and what you think yourself, do you think that the whole status of teaching and maybe some of these other public servants are slowly sliding in society?
Yeah, my perception, and this is my personal perception, is that it's become far too easy to go, oh, I'm going to teach, and you do a PGCE and there you are, suddenly you're a teacher. It should be like nursing. It should be a vocation. You should actually have a passion for it. I'm a Bristolian. I was educated in Bristol. I went to the Redmayne School, and I have to say I had fantastic teachers. I was very, very fortunate. But we respected our teachers. We were disciplined. But I think also we've got to recognise that education actually starts at home. And if children respect their parents and also are respected by their parents, then it's going to be easier in schools. But schools need to be allowed to discipline children. And I'm not talking about the birch. I'm not talking about hitting children. I'm talking about children knowing that there are consequences for misbehaving. You cannot educate unless there is discipline, because you need to be able to educate all of the children, and if you have one or two disruptive children within a class, it makes it impossible for everybody else to learn.
Now, there's been some discussion this week about grammar schools and the selection at 11. What are your thoughts about that, with wisdom or otherwise of that?
See, I am biased. I genuinely feel that unfortunately we have very, very poor education within Bristol outside of the private schools. My son is quite profoundly dyslexic, and when he was young we moved out to Backwell because they had excellent schools out there. As the dyslexia was discovered, we then made a decision that actually I was going to forego any sort of lifestyle so that I could put him through private school, because I knew how intelligent he was. And he passed his 11 plus. He went to QEH. He had an excellent grounding. But at that school, there was discipline. He wasn't a number. He was an individual. And those teachers taught him. And no, he didn't get the grades that I wanted him to get. He didn't get the grades that he now knows he could have got if he'd worked a bit harder. But it was the grounding that he got overall, not just the grades in his GCSEs and A-levels. It was about the entire environment within that school. And we need to recognise education isn't just about the grades. It's about developing the children as individuals.
Well, I mean, I come from a teacher's family. My father was the youngest headmaster in Britain in 1956, the man most likely to. He used to teach in inner city schools. My mother was a head of English, again, in comprehensive schools. I went to comprehensive school. I did get to grammar school, but it went comprehensive in the first year. I was the first kid from my school to go to Oxford on a scholarship when I was 16. And so what I would say is my father in the 1980s, I remember sitting in the pub with him, and he was totally, totally opposed to what the Thatcher government was doing with education. And he said to me, I've got the chance to take early retirement, 10 years early, and I'm so opposed to what they're doing that I'm tempted to take it. I've still got another 10 years teaching in me, but actually I'm tempted to take it. And you know what? He was a smart working class kid. He took it.
But didn't he let the children down by doing that? You know,
he would have died of a heart attack. He would have died of a heart attack. All this stuff about education, I used to listen to it around the breakfast table when I was a kid. And I've been a teacher as well. I used to teach A-levels and I used to teach primary. And I went on the march with the teachers when we were all on strike. Lovely people, okay, as always.
Absolutely.
And you know what? People are absolutely fed up with people at the top imposing national curriculums and the whole thing of schools. What's really pernicious is schools, the money goes with the kids. My dad said to me, I really opposed to what the Tory government in the 80s. He said, I run a tough school, White Cross. And the kids, people don't want to go to my school. And what I said is, if we're going to have the situation where kids can go to other schools and all the rest of it, we're going to have a market, which is silly. I used to go to the school that everybody went to when I was a kid. We all just walked down the road. But the point is, the money shouldn't go with the kids. You can go to the popular school with 30 kids in the class, or the unpopular school with 15 kids in the class. But of course, what we got now, we've got Colston Girls' School, which is being absorbed into the system, which means that Downend is going to lose money. And that's why my dad resigned.
Hang on a minute. If you have a class with 15 in it, don't you then think that that school is actually going to vastly improve because
that's
it's going to be easier?
Have the money going with the kids.
I'm not disagreeing with you, but I'm sorry, you still haven't covered the issue about the fact that education starts at home. And if the parents don't instill in their children a will to learn, and if we have households that don't have a single book in them, and we have children that aren't disciplined at home, then how on earth are they meant to be given an education at school? Well,
I'm going to put this to both of you, because we're in a situation now where thousands of people across the city are having to move, parents anyway, to try and make sure there's children get in the catchment area for the school they want. This is a really competitive thing.
I did exactly that. I moved out of Bristol from Henbury. I moved out to Backwell because at that time the infants, juniors and senior school were superb. By the time Toby was due to go to senior school, I'm sorry, there were over 2,000 children there. He would have been able to hide. It was not the best place for him. I up sticks and moved again. At my expense, at my cost, because I wanted the best for my child. And people should not be having children for the sake of the fact that it's the end result of procreation, or sex rather, because actually sex is meant to be about procreation as well as fun. We should be having children because you want to bring children into this world. You want to nurture them. You want to care for them. You want the best for them, not to throw them out the door because they're making a noise and they're under your feet.
Martin, what about this business of the situation we're now in, where so many parents are having to move, literally move house, to try and get into the right schools? There's quite a competitive thing out there. In the old days, actually, most schools were similar. You know, there were much more similarities.
When my parents went into state school teaching in the 1950s, there was a real idealism about it. We're going to go into these poor communities and we're going to open things up, give them aspirations. Now, what all teachers on the front line, like my sister, who works in a unit with kids who've been kicked out of other schools, know, the real inner city school teachers know, that in actual fact, there's a big number of people in this society who don't care about their kids.
And if Absolutely. The teachers don't care about them, then nobody's going to care about
yes.
them.
So
and
why is it so easy for people to get in to be teachers when they don't actually want to do it? They're just
nobody wants to do it. My dad resigned, my sister's walked away from it. Nobody wants to do it.
No, I disagree. I'm sorry, there are people out there that want to do it.
At the Red Maids, maybe.
Otherwise, you'd have everybody sat at home doing nothing because nobody would want to do anything. You know, but the thing is we need to allow discipline back into schools. We need to
my
allow
dad was a famously tough headmaster.
Yeah, well, okay. Exactly. Exactly. So
and
we're
he hated the Tory government and everything they stood for.
Hang on a minute. Thatcher was extremely tough.
Yes, and she went to a private school. She was grammar school, wasn't she? I used to meet these people at Oxford University. They're all privately educated, like Cameron, all these Eton people.
Do
you know what? They don't know nothing about what goes on the front line in inner city schools. Now, absolutely.
Martin, one thing particularly, can I just calm you both down a second here? Because one thing kids do not decide is which school they go to. It's the parents that decide that. It's really not fair, Martin, to be blaming individuals. Martin, it's really not fair to blame individuals for the school that their parents sent them to, is it?
No, and lots of kids go to schools because that's where they end up. And those kids actually don't have people with big elbows to fight for them. They need their teachers to stand up for them, and that's what their teachers are supposed to do.
Okay,
absolutely. But the thing is you've now brought into this argument and are making it about privately educated versus state educated.
Absolutely.
All teachers ought to be as good as each other.
In the private sector, they don't even have to have a PGCE, do they? I taught in the private sector.
Well,
no problem.
But without a PGCE?
Oh, absolutely. You've got an Oxford degree, they just say, yeah, on you go.
Yeah, but the thing is there are good teachers and there are bad teachers.
There are indeed.
Everywhere.
There are indeed.
So, I'm sorry, I was very fortunate. Red Maids is an excellent school.
I know it is. I know people who went there, who are my friends, you know.
I've
got a problem. But it does worry me that people making education policy know nothing about what goes on in inner city schools. They really don't. Not a clue.
Isn't it inevitable in a situation in the finances the way they are, that one of the most important things that we spend our public money on, education,
Absolutely.
Is going to go down? It's gonna, you know, just like everything else, there's going to be cuts.
See, that's where we're going wrong. We can't cut education. If we cut education, we've got an illiterate population. We're going to have more unemployment. We're not going to be able to reinstate the innovation, the entrepreneurship that we've had in this country. We need to concentrate on education for our youngsters, and we need to instill that will in them to strive for the best. If we make them learn how to work hard at school, they'll work hard out of school.
But how are we going to do that with the central government that's cutting all the time? I mean, that's the problem, surely.
Well, it does then come back to good and bad teachers. I'm not saying a bad teacher should be thrown out after one term. You've got to give people the opportunity to make those improvements. I agree about the national curriculum. I agree about constantly testing schools. Teachers should be allowed to teach.
Testing has just become absolutely ridiculous.
I agree. Absolutely.
Five-year-olds are tested. Ridiculous.
Agreed. We need to focus on what is right for the education of the children.
And the whole child.
Absolutely. Agreed.
I mean, what my sister was doing in the unit she was working in is keeping those kids out of prison.
Yes.
Like their parents. And that's the best thing they can do. Just keep them out of prison.
It's not just about keeping them out of prison.
Those kids
it's about
in particular, that's
them,
what they were doing.
Yes, but it's also about giving them that sense of purpose for themselves and also knowing that they are individuals in their own
lives. Okay, folks, that's it for this hour. Thanks to this week's guest you just heard there. And that's discussion about education. Conservative Councillor Ravenmouth, Group Spokesperson for Transport for the Conservatives, Siobhan Kennedy Hall. After the news, mayhem in Syria. Plus, we look at the Leveson Inquiry.
Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the